Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 32 of Season 5 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Richard Kirkham of Kirkham, A Movie a Day, and the Shepherd of the Lambcast. Welcome back, Richard.
Glad to be here. I hope I'm not pissing in somebody's pool.
I hope not too, because I'm fresh out of chlorine. So minute 32 begins with Burke reporting to Stuart and ends with John trying to explain the situation. This minute begins where we left off yesterday. Yesterday we left off with Burke getting ready to report, and today he actually begins his report. And it's a pretty quick report also. He doesn't really say very much, but we get a few more seconds of John Leguizamo, where he then takes out his walkie-talkie and he puts it up to his mouth. And then as he's putting it up to his mouth, the shot changes and we get a shot of Stuart. So we get William Sadler again, and we hear over the radio, "All systems tapped, Colonel." And then we have Stuart saying, "Fired up." And my first question, and we'll find this out later on, I wonder if this is the only dialogue that John Leguizamo has in the entire movie. I can't recall hearing him and doing anything else. So obviously, as we go through, we'll see. But I have a feeling this might be pretty much it. He's got all systems tapped, Colonel.
Yeah, I suspect it is. There are so many of those guys who simply are there to be shot and killed, as opposed to providing any exposition.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see about that. Stuart then gives the order, and then we see that there's all this equipment around him, and the men start turning on all the equipment, and we see that it looks like equipment that one would use control tower. Yeah. That's what it looks like. It made me wonder also, where do you buy this type of stuff? This is you can't just go into the Sharper Image and say, okay, well, I need a I need this, that, and the other thing in order to start landing planes.
Well, I'm always amazed at the availability of tools, equipment, specialized materials, because somebody is manufacturing all this stuff and they have to be supplying people for all kinds of reasons, and it's not custom made for every control tower or every terrorist who's in the neighborhood looking for a way to take over things.
Correct.
It has to be available somewhere, and it just is a matter of figuring out how to acquire it. That's why you have somebody who's the equivalent of a scrounger on your terrorist team.
That's right. But my assumption is that this is also very costly. I doubt they're renting this equipment. It's a question of going over on the black market and getting them, or maybe they're stolen from somewhere.
That's another one of those things that could easily be the case. They stole it from someplace. That's probably pretty typical. If this movie was another half hour, we might have seen that sequence where all of the equipment was stolen. There would have been a tactical attack on some nearby airport, maybe a military installation, and they'd have we'd have gotten an extra set of violence there.
Right, but if that was the case, if they took over another one, then they wouldn't have to move the stuff to to this farmhouse. It would be much, or to the church. It would be much more difficult to do it that way. Because the idea is they want to be close by.
Somebody to the airport that they're going to be staging their attack at.
Correct.
So I think if you've got the equipment from someplace in Nevada, that it's not going to do you much good to hold on to that control tower in Nevada when you need the equipment in Dulles in Washington, D.C.
Right. We're just supposed to believe that they somehow got it. But you'd also think that, they must have a lot of funding in order to pay for this. Or at least the promise of funding.
Well, I assume that that's all paid for by the drug money from the general.
Yeah. But they it makes you wonder if he's already paid them or if it's a promise, you give him a promissory note.
Well, I tell you, the whole concept of Colonel Stuart and the general from this country
Valverde
is based on, you know, the idea that Oliver North was going around the restrictions that had been imposed on backing up the sand, not the the Contras, down in
Nicaragua,
Central America, and El Salvador in particular, and that there were leaders of countries down there that were engaged in this kind of economic activity. Noriega is the name that jumps out. So you would assume that if this was paramilitated with the CIA, that they were immersed in the enterprise with the general, and so they probably have their own resources.
Right.
I don't worry too much about it. If I did that, I wouldn't be able to get through most movies.
That's true. No, obviously, but it's fun to think about it, you know, when we're going through it minute by minute. That's the idea.
Yeah, how many pounds of cocaine did they have to sell to
exactly
be able to afford all the equipment that's there and pay off all of the soldiers that are going to be involved in this process?
That's right.
So they're not all there just because they're patriots.
Right. It's cocaine meth.
Yep.
You know, why not? That's, you know, these are the type of questions that they're going to give their kids in school. You know, how many kilos of cocaine does your son need to sell in order to be able to finance, you know, taking over a Dulles airport? You never know.
One of those math questions. If 4 pounds of cocaine is traveling at 375 miles an hour toward Dulles Airport, and a general is traveling at 600 miles an hour to Dulles Airport, which is going to arrive first? You know.
That's right. That's right. Show your work. And then we get Stuart pacing around the room, and then he goes, H minus 5 minutes, stand by. Which made me wonder, what the hell is H? You know, I can understand if you were to say, you know, 0 hour, or, you know, there's a whole bunch of different things you could say. But H? Heist?
It probably stands for hour. It's probably some reference, a technical military reference that we don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure the tech advisor had a reason for suggesting it.
Could be. Well, we'll see if it's in the script when we get there, but we'll find that out. And then the shot goes back to the control tower. Trudeau say, all right, we've got a body in the morgue that seems to have died twice. Assuming it's not a computer error, what do we assume? Then John turns to me and says that somebody's about to f*** this airport. What the hell is that supposed to mean? I know we're dummies up here. So give us a taste of your genius. This is a hijacking, a robbery, or what? Look, I'm not sure. Oh, he's not sure. I'm stunned. I love the way that Lorenzo delivers that line. You know, it's great. You know, he goes, I gotta go lie down. And then John responds and says, the only people that go to this much trouble are professionals, not luggage thieves and not punks. Professional at what? And then John waves the dossier and goes, what the f*** do you think this is? The safety patrol? This is the resume of a professional mercenary. And then the minute gets cut off as he's saying that. I like the argument that the two of them are having here, basically. John here is the guy who's cautious and knows that something nefarious is going on. And, you know, he just has to try and convince. I mean, John always thinks that, obviously, because he keeps getting to these type of situations where, you know, he's supposed to be in a normal situation and terrorists happen to show up. So, and, you know, Trudeau, who's just trying to, you know, as we said yesterday, he's the airport COO. So he just wants things to run smoothly. You know, it's Christmas week. We got to get things done and that's it.
And yeah, but he does get a little contaminated by Lorenzo's attitude because he's got that facetious response, you know, well, we're, you know, share your genius with us.
Yeah, we're dummies here.
We're dummies here.
Give us a taste of your genius.
I think Lorenzo's starting to have some impact on Trudeau, although Trudeau seems more reasonable. And this has always been one of my problems with this movie in general. Dennis Franz's character is just written to be an idiot from the very beginning.
That's
and
right.
You wonder how he ever rose to a position of authority, much less the head of security. operating the way he does. And, you know, of course, McClane gets to make the same kinds of comments as he goes along. But this is one of those examples that he's full of bluster. That's the only way that he can respond to anything.
Right. But you can say the same thing about Dwayne T. Robinson from the first movie.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess, you know,
that's a character fault of all of those secondary characters. They are incompetent at their job,
which helps John do his job better.
Right. It makes him look better.
That's right. Now, he mentions, you know, the safety patrol. Have you ever heard of the safety patrol before?
Well, you know, I think that that's one of those generic terms. You might have the safety patrol in elementary school that is making sure that kids are adhering to the rules on the playground, that they're not throwing rocks at each other or climbing up on the equipment in a manner that is potentially dangerous. When you were in school, there was probably somebody who was responsible for that. Usually it was an older kid who was considered responsible by the teachers.
Okay. All right. You're very close. So basically, the Junior Safety Patrol is a group that's crossing guards that involves older students helping younger students cross streets in both elementary and middle schools across the U.S., both in St. Paul and Chicago. They started programs in 1920 to be able to have older kids help with crossing the street. As of the 90s, there were already 76% of communities across the U.S. They have something similar to the safety patrol. AAA is actually a partner in it. And AAA supplies training materials, badges, orange or neon green, you know, belts that you can use when crossing people that cross the street, stuff like that. Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton were both safety patrol members when they were kids, as was Joe Garagiola, who was
the baseball player.
That's right. Lee Iacocca, the former chairman of Chrysler. He also was. Chief Justice Warren Burger was also one. And 21 astronauts have been in the safety patrol. I didn't see the list, so I couldn't tell you what this is. But they said that the main thing that they teach in the safety patrol is direct children, not traffic, which means that, you know, your job is to make sure that the kids know when they can cross and when they can't cross, not trying to stop the traffic or anything like that.
Yeah, that's the job of the crossing guards.
That's right. That's right. And then the other thing that jumped out at me was the idea of a mercenary. So, first of all, do you know other names for a mercenary?
Well, you know, they are, I think that's the generic term. The first time I heard it was when they were talking about the Hessians back in the Revolutionary War. They were mercenaries that were employed by the British. I don't know that there are other terms. They're paid professionals. We have contract operators nowadays that might be described as mercenaries. You know, and mercenary is the term that was always used when they were talking about people who were fighting for pay in those Central American and African civil wars that went on so right. often in the mm-hmm. 1960s and 70s.
Correct. So they're also known as Soldiers of Fortune.
Yeah, there you go. There's a magazine, Soldier of Fortune.
That's
magazine.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's right. They're known as hired guns, but mostly they're either known as mercenaries or mercs. Okay, and basically they are people, as you said, who fight for money or other forms of payment instead of for political interests. You know, the reason that they're there is to get paid. In the 20th century, they actually stopped, like the rules of war stopped, you know, giving protection to people who are considered as mercenaries. So even the Geneva Convention says that they're not recognized as legitimate combatants, and you don't have to give them the same protections as other captured personnel might be. I mean, I remember when I moved to Israel. So it was before I became a citizen, and I volunteered to join the army here. And I had to sign a paper saying that if something ever happens to me, I've retroactively became a citizen when I signed up, so that I wouldn't be considered a mercenary.
There you go.
You know, so I find that to be, for me, the idea of potentially being considered a mercenary is scarier, because especially if you know you're not a mercenary.
Well, that only works if you're in combat with another nation. So if Syria or Egypt was attacking Israel, then you'd be covered. But if you're dealing with a terrorist organization, they don't give a crap about that anyway.
That's right. They treat everyone the same. That's true. It's a very, very good point. So, I mean, this minute doesn't give us that much, but it does give us some interesting, conflict between the characters, where John is basically trying to win Trudeau over because he knows that he's got no chance of winning Lorenzo over. Lorenzo has no interest in siding with John. As far as he's concerned, as he says, John's got no authorization here at all. So, that's pretty much all we have for this minute. Do you have anything else before we get into the script?
I do not.
Okay. So, first of all, the conversation with Burke is slightly different, not much, but it's slightly different. So, Burke says we're hot instead of saying all systems tapped, Colonel. But obviously, all systems tapped is better, because it lets us know a little bit more about what's going on. And then Stewart says light it up instead of fire it up. Again, very sim very very similar. It could just be something the actor decided to change. Then the script says the signal is given, switches are thrown, camera pans over and up to the choir loft, which is electronic heaven. Everything comes online. And then Stewart says 5 minutes to 0 hour, stand by. And then we go back to, the control tower, and the conversation is a little different. John says, "I think something serious is going to happen here tonight." And then Trudeau says, "Hey, something serious happens every night, only it doesn't make the newspapers. Ever see those guys on TV juggling knives and chainsaws? That's what we're doing with those planes up there. Only we do it one-handed, because the other hand's playing three-card monte with the planes on the ground. Anybody try and fix the deck tonight? Anything weird going on besides the shooting?" That's what McLean says that. And then Barnes says, "We did lose FAA approach control." McLean goes, "What's that?" "One way we manage the planes, but we've got backup." And a long look from McLean. "Okay, you got backups. Backup for everything you think can go wrong. What about something nobody anticipated? Not accidents, not weather." Then Trudeau says dryly, "The human element?" McLean goes, "Damn straight, the human element." And that's it. So it's very different. There are pluses and minuses to the added dialogue here. I mean, I like the fact that they already mentioned to John that something has gone wrong, because in the script that was mentioned earlier, they had the extra scene where, something went offline already. But on the other hand, I still like the way they do it in the movie itself. So I think either way works. And I like the fact that we have a more animated Trudeau, because in the script he's not very animated with what he says here, because he's dryly talking about the human element. And his speech about what they do every day is actually cool to hear, but I don't know if it would have been viable, to have it on screen the way that he says it. Talking about them juggling knives and chainsaws, and then
Yeah.
playing three card monte with the other hand. It's also a little too. He's patting himself on the back a little too much as to, what they do there.
Well, I think you get a good sense that there's already plenty of complications that they have to deal with, and that just makes it's superfluous narration and exposition.
Correct.
We get the idea. They're very busy. There's a lot that can go wrong.
Yes, there definitely is. And there's a lot that will go wrong for that very same reason. Every Tuesday, we have a segment called Disaster Tuesday. And this segment is basically I've scoured the internets, to find some sort of disaster, airplane disaster that happened. Generally, it's about someone famous. And I try to find something that is at least geographically close to where my guest is from. So, have you ever heard the name, Richard, of Henry John Deutschendorf Jr.?
Is that John Denver?
Yes, it is. Very good. I never knew that was his name. That his name was Deutschendorf. So, yes, John Denver, who was born December 31st, 1943, and passed away on October 12th, 1997, at the age of 53. Okay. He is an American guitarist, singer, composer, actor, humanitarian, and environmentalist. And he's mostly known for popularizing acoustic folk music in the 1970s. He recorded and released about 300 songs. 200 of them he composed himself. He had 33 albums and singles that were certified gold or platinum in the U.S. He mostly sang about joy in nature, disdain for city life, enthusiasm for music, and relationship trials. Okay. Do you know what happened to him on October 12th, 1997?
Well, I know that he was flying what is deemed an experimental aircraft, and it failed.
Pretty much, yeah. And do you know where he crashed?
I'm trying to remember. I thought I was in California, but maybe it's in Texas.
No, it is in California. It's in California. And I when I think of you, I think of California. What can I tell you? You know,
That's where I lived for 62 years.
So. There you go. That's why, I still think of you as a Californian. You know, sorry.
That's okay.
Where in California do you think it? Do you remember where it happened in California?
I couldn't say for sure. Probably the Central Valley somewhere.
Okay, I'll mention the name and you'll know probably where it is. I don't know specifically, how far it was from you. He crashed in Monterey Bay, which is near Pacific Grove, California.
Yeah, Monterey Bay is up on the near south of San Francisco. There's a college there, and there's a very nice aquarium there in that area also. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful area, and if he was on the coast, there's not a lot of places to crash.
Well, he crashed in the water.
You're going to get out of it easy because it's a rough area.
Right. Well, I mean, basically, as you said, his plane, it wasn't just that it was an experimental craft. It was a home-built aircraft. Okay, meaning someone just put it together in their garage or their backyard or whatever it is and sold it to him. He himself had over 2,700 hours of flight experience. He was known as an accomplished pilot. Okay, but he wasn't legally allowed to fly at the time of the crash. Okay, he had been arrested numerous times for drunk driving, and in 1996, about a year before the accident. The FAA learned that he wasn't able to maintain sobriety. Therefore, they revoked flight license, his medical certification to fly, right? I want to state that according to, the autopsy and everything like that, he did not, there was no sign of alcohol or drug use in his body at the time, but he wasn't supposed to be flying regardless of it. Now, apparently, when they did the investigation after the accident, they realized that the problem was that it was his inability to switch fuel tanks during flight. Okay, he basically flew far enough that he needed to switch between the two gas tanks or the fuel tanks that they have on the plane. And when the person built this aircraft, they actually put the switch behind the pilot seat, meaning someone else should theoretically be doing it, if you have someone else in the plane, but he was there on his own and he had to try and, twist around and, flip the switch in order to switch the fuel from being taken from one tank to the other tank. Okay. So that basically the pilot needs to turn his body 90 degrees in order to reach the valve. And what this does is this created a natural tendency to extend one's right foot against the right rudder pedal to support oneself while turning in the seat, which caused the aircraft to yaw, nose right, and pitch up, which basically ended up causing the the accident, and eventually, you know, he unfortunately died in this accident. So yeah, it's basically, you know, they didn't build this aircraft properly, which is a little bit of a problem. So yeah, unfortunately, that's what happened to John Denver. Okay, so Richard, you want to tell people how they can get in touch with Richard Kirkham?
Hey, I'm available at the Lamcast, which you can find at the Large Association of Movie Blogs, largeassmovieblogs.com. And you can also find me at Kirkham A Movie A Day. There are two Kirkham A Movie A Day sites. One is kirkhamclass.blogspot.com. The other is kirkhamamovieaday.com. Both have the same content, but the Blogspot site is a little bit easier to access.
All right, great. And while you're doing that, you can rate, review, and subscribe to any podcatcher you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter. So, Richard, do you feel like coming back again tomorrow?
Absolutely. You know, there's going to be something I'm going to want to talk about tomorrow, I'm sure.
All right, well, maybe there's something
you're going to do.
You know, just report anything unusual, however trivial it is.
Okay, well, you give me $20 and I'll let you do that.
All right, sounds good. All right, so until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay, everybody.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here and